Today, we're talking about MS, multiple sclerosis. That's a hard one, but we call it the silent disease, a disease that affects your spinal cord and your brain. It attacks the central nervous system and can be debilitating. Talk about what it is, how it can affect you, and how, in this case, to live with it. My guest is Debbie Zavidson. She is a longtime music executive and publisher who has lived with MS now for more than 20 years. So we talk health, love, life, and song. All right. So welcome to our fourth episode of The Good Enough Woman. Today we have Debbie Zavidson. So yay. I gotta admit something though.
What?
This is actually our second interview. Oh,
you didn't have to admit that.
Yeah, I already admitted it online for anybody that saw. Oh. And so I just thought I'd go ahead and throw it out there and say the last time we recorded, such an awesome conversation. I loved it so much. I don't know that we'll remember all the things we talked about, but it's okay. And I hit record on the video. Mm-hmm. So the video was working, but the sound on the video wasn't working. And then somewhere in like minute 25, we lost everything we had said. So you were gracious enough to say, should we do it again? And I was like, yes, let's get together and talk again.
Of course, we're going to get this. This is a wonderful podcast. It's a wonderful idea. And we need to get it off the ground and do what we can here to get this word out there.
Yeah.
Because we're good enough, dagummit.
Well, and I love that you just said that too, because for those of the that don't know our relationship, I mean, you were my first publisher. Mm-hmm. And you really did help me get off the ground in so many ways already. And here you are still doing that. And so thank you for being here today.
Of course. I love you. You know that.
I know. In this hot room, we're hot in here, people. It's hot. But I'm going to work on that later. So last time we talked about a lot of things. I'm going to try to be a little... She is looking at me through the... I did change my seat so I could see you a little bit better.
Okay. Well, I wish I could see you better, but you go ahead.
So last time we talked about... Just kidding. We talked about your early teens. And I do want to kind of go back to that a little bit just because I want people to hear how you got here to mm-hmm. Nashville. Mm-hmm. You grew up in California, in San Jose area.
Mm-hmm. Grew up playing music. My dad played music and had my own band after a while and decided when I was 27 that I wanted to try to go to Nashville and become a country music star. So I came when I was 27.
And you sang and you played bass. That's mm-hmm. what I thought. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, well, let me ask you a little bit about that part, though, because I want to know, were you an active teen? You were always out playing. How many nights a week did you play?
I played all the... I mean, when I got in my first band, we played every weekend. We went to Fort Ord and played every weekend there. We were playing during the day. We were doing car dealership openings and pizza parlors. I mean, I made a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
I mean, it was ridiculous.
Did you play in malls?
We played in malls.
Yeah, that was a big thing.
One time we played at a RV center and we played on top of a Winnebago. We got all our equipment up there and we were actually on top of that thing. And the highway was out there and people were stopping and waving and hollering and it was fun.
Oh, that sounds fun. I love that. Nobody fell through the roof, though. That's good.
Thank God. It was a good, sturdy Winnebago.
So if you need a vehicle to travel across the country, Winnebago's other way to go. So we're going to fast forward pretty quickly through that because you came to Nashville. And tell me what happened once you moved to Nashville.
I got in with some bands around town and played different clubs around and was writing and just trying to do whatever I could. But as you can't really make very much money playing music like I was used to. So I ended up getting a job with US Air in reservations. And I was able to fly home whenever I got terribly homesick. And I was able to make enough money. I had insurance, which I'd never had before. I had a steady check, which I'd never had before. And I also had a hard job that I never had before. I always loved what I did. But I did that for 3 years. And then I married Russ. And well, I swore to myself that I would stay for 3 years because I knew I was going to be homesick. And you have to stay and pull through the hard part. But I was going to be 30 this year, the year I was going to be 30. I was going to move home. I was planning to go home. I was going on a USO tour that year in February, and I was going to be gone 3 months. And then I was going and I was packing up, and I said, okay, this is it. Nothing has happened. I haven't got a record deal. So I'm 30. I get to go home. Oh my God. Thank God. I was so homesick. And Russ Abbotson asked me to go out with him. And I mean, we went out the night before I went on that tour in February. I came back 3 months later. We were married in September.
Wow.
And that was the beginning of that saga. So
a USO tours. That was probably something that changed the course of my beliefs. I wouldn't say my belief system, but definitely really got to the core of why we do music or why we live where we live, and I was always appreciative of being lucky enough to be born in the United States, but that definitely gave me.
Me too. Whole. I thought every teenager in the United States should have to go over to Korea or somewhere like where we went and see how they live and how different it is. And so they would appreciate what we have here. It's incredible. And they are over there defending us even now. The DMZ. I mean, it's no joke.
Yeah. We went to Bahrain and
I went to Bahrain. Loved it.
Oh, man. So different.
And yeah, it's incredible.
It is. And to really connect with people who, like you, were very homesick. And just to have a piece of home.
And they were kids.
Yeah.
They were so young.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear you.
Well, so, and then you, when did you decide, okay, I'm not going to do music anymore?
Well, I actually.
Perform music anymore.
Yeah. I got a job as Doug Johnson's production assistant. And I was just, I wanted to get into the music business and do something in there. I mean, Russ encouraged me to quit that job at the airline and get into the business. So I did. I got a job with Doug. And at the same time, I was establishing my place with him. I was recording some things with John Besner. He wanted to try to get a record deal for me. And the very week that Doug got offered the job as head of A&R for Epic Records, and wanted me to go with him as his A&R right arm, whatever. John had taken our stuff to RCA Records and gotten us a demo budget that she liked what we did. And she was going to let us go in and cut some more stuff. So I had to decide that Friday, actually, if I was going to stay in that side of the business, like A&R and what I was doing there, or was I going to give that up and just go for it and try to get a record deal? And I had to decide because it was a conflict of interest to work for Epic and have a deal with RCA because they weren't connected at the time. So I decided that weekend that I had seen enough by that time and decided if I ever could have a family, I wanted to have a family still. And I wanted to, you know, and I loved the songs. I mean, I love, that's what it is for me anyway, songs and songwriters. So I saw what that life was and I thought, well, just because that's always been my dream doesn't have to still be my dream. I can have a new dream.
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
And it was still in music, something you still love. So from there, you went to Epic and then you were there for how many years?
We were there for 5 years, had a good run there, signed the Kinleys there, and had some great success over there. It was one of the best 5 years of my life. Absolutely. And then Doug got offered to go to Giant Records as president, and he made me his head of A&R. At Giant. And we were there for 3 years. And that was a whole different kind of experience because Sony Epic was a company, a big conglomerate. And Giant was owned by Irving Azoff. And it was a different kind of an independent label. So it was another kind of experience. But I loved that too and had a great time.
And how did you go from, just walk me through really quickly, how you went through being a singer-songwriter to then being the head of A&R. What were the steps you took to get there?
Well, it just kind of happened because when you work for a producer or an A&R person or an artist or whatever, publishers and songwriters want to get their songs to that person. And so they try to pitch their songs to anybody in that little world that they can. And since I was his assistant, Missy Gallimore, or Callis at the time, was trying to become a song plugger, and she worked at Pride's publishing company. And she just called me out of the blue one day after we just finished Doug Stone's second album. And she said, "Hey, we just got this song out of the studio. Can you come and hear it? Would you come and listen to it?" And I'm like, sure. I don't guess so. I mean, nobody had ever asked me to play me a song. But I went over there and she played me this song and it just about blew my mind. I mean, I loved it. I still remember how much I loved it. And I said, "Well, we're already done with the project, so I don't know what to do." She goes, "Well, can you just play it anyway?" And I was like, "Well, I'll take it." And I took it home that night and I played it for Russ because I never played Doug a song. I wasn't sure what if I should. And I played it for Russ and he didn't get it. He didn't think it was even right. And I said, "Well, I just love it." And he goes, "Well, Deb, the first rule is if you love it, you play it. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what Doug thinks. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. If you love it, pitch it." And I was like, "Okay." And I went in the next morning and I said, "Hey," I was very scared. I said, "Can I play you a song I just found?" And he said, "Sure." So he played it. And he played the whole thing and then he turned it off and he said, "Hey, book the studio for Saturday. We're going to cut that song. That is a hit." And I was like, "Whoa, that was easy. Okay." And we did and he did and it was. And I just continued to listen to songs for him. I just found a lot of hits. I just went by that rule. If I love it enough, somebody else is going to love it.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing as a songwriter as well is to... You just have to write what's in your heart that day or what's coming to your mind. And you have to really quiet all of the other things around you to say mm-hmm. that it may be good or it may not be good, but it doesn't matter. It is part of you no matter what. And sometimes my mom used to always say to me, you know, that you learn this from writing papers too. Just get the stuff out. I remember, and I think it was somebody right along that first time, and it probably was you, to be honest, where you just said, just say everything. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter if it's good in your mind, say it, because when you say it, you might inspire somebody else to say something better.
Absolutely. And I probably did tell you that because I tell every writer that. You're nervous about saying stuff and co-writes and stuff. You don't want to say something stupid. You don't want to say something and everybody go, "Okay, let's get that guy out of here." Whatever you say might be the thing that pops somebody else's mind into saying something else. It's never stupid.
Yeah.
Because you are a creator and a writer, and that's what you do. If you censor yourself, then, you
could be censoring greatness.
You could.
Yeah.
And you probably would be.
Yeah. So I always loved that. So you went on to, then you were at Giant, I know you signed an artist that is still around.
Signed Blake Shelton. And that was absolute labor of love from the get-go. I loved everything that came out of that guy's mouth.
He's got great pitch.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He was a great singer. He is a great singer. And he was, so funny and so genuine and wanted it for the right reasons and had so many people pulling for him. And Bobby Braddock, it was his first record to produce. And that was a big deal to me. And I wanted it to happen for them. And so thankfully, poor guy though, we signed him first and everybody else we signed after him came out before he did. And his first record didn't come out until we were about to close our doors. But it was worth it because it was the song Austin that we'd found. And it wasn't just any song. It was so special. And he sang it so good. It was meant to be.
Yeah. So when you guys closed the doors at Giant, you ended up becoming
his manager.
His manager for a little mm-hmm. while.
Yeah. He hadn't really needed a manager until that point. And I said, "Look, you've got to get out there and interview some managers." And he was like, "I'd just rather do it with you. I trust you." And I said, "I know, but I've never done it before. And I want to do it and I think I can, but it's not fair to you if you don't go talk to some real managers and see what they have to say. They might say something to change your mind." He went and talked to two or three managers and he just didn't. He's no bullshit. He's no, yeah. He can kind of read through stuff. And so we went ahead and I asked John Doris to co-manage with me so I'd have some experience there. And I did that for almost 2 years, the first part of his career there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But which brings us actually to a really good point, because we're getting to what I want to talk to you about today. What were the reasons why you stepped down?
I know. Gosh. I didn't have my kids till later in life. And I had my son when I was 35 and my daughter when I was 42. And they were both young still. I mean, she was 3 and he was 10. And it was very crazy. When you're a manager, it's almost like being an on-call doctor. You have to be taking care of stuff, putting out fires, being available at all time. And he trusted me to do that and be wherever I need to be and do whatever I need to do. And my kids started, I mean, they were fine at first, and they thought it was, you know, Tony thought it was really cool. But I'll never forget, we were at our regular Monday night pizza thing at Mr. Gaddy's, and my kids, and I had to go take a call. I had to leave the pizza parlor to go out, I went back in, and my kids were like, do we ever get to have you when you don't leave? When you don't leave, right when we're doing something? I mean, I was like, yes, you do. You get that. I don't always. But it really kind of got me. And I knew I wanted to be a Girl Scout leader, and I wanted to be a homeroom mother. And I could not do those things. I couldn't volunteer for that stuff. So I decided I might get another chance to manage somebody or whatever, but I will never get another chance to do what I want to do with my kids. And so that was it. I just said, you know what? I love you, Blake Shelton, and you're going to do great, but I love my kids more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he understood. He was very,
he did.
Very cool about it.
Yeah, of course he did. It's a hard thing to acknowledge. Now you're finally at a place in your career where you've always wanted to be, and you've worked your way up and you're really making waves, but at the end of the day, we do. Mm-hmm. And I remember my bass player, you were a bass player too, so it's funny that he should say it, but remember Anthony he was on dialysis.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah.
And he used to play with Face, and he played with a bunch of people, but he said to me one day, he said, Corrine, I know you're having a fun time right now. He said, but I just want to be honest with you. When you have kids, you may not be doing this anymore. And I was like, what? Yes, mm-hmm. Of course I will. But, you know, in a way, he was very right. If a woman has not made it to, and by made it, that's a hard phrase, I think, to say, because there are so many different levels of making it. Mm-hmm. I got to do a lot of really cool things in music, but was I able to allow my husband to stop working to come on the road with me? No, I didn't have that much money to just live a life that we wanted. So, I mean, he was right in that way. If a woman has not made it by the time she wants to have kids, it's a hard road, because you have to give up.
And
at the end of the day,
odd? I have a little problem with that, honestly, just because the dads, they're still trying to make it. It's an interesting thing. Some dads, I think, can be the nurturer.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that.
Absolutely.
And it's wonderful. But I'd always wanted to be a mom.
Yeah.
Since I was a little kid, I wanted to be a mom. I wanted to have a lot of kids. And I wasn't able to have kids till I was old. I just never could have them for whatever reason. And it was like, I wanted that experience.
Yeah.
Russ could have it if he wanted it, but he'd have to get out of the way a little bit, because I wanted it. That's all I wanted.
Yeah.
And it was hard to accept that I wasn't going to, I'm not going to stay there. You know, get out of that and then go back, and
not to the same extent.
Very easy.
Yeah, not to the degree that you were.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Because it took a long time to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it was more than worth it. I wouldn't change
it. It's a constant pivot, I think. And I find joy in those little moments that I know I wouldn't get. And,
yes.
And I do remember thinking to myself too, and it was a decision at that moment. My husband's very supportive.
Yes.
He would have said, keep doing it, do whatever you're doing, we'll make it work, all that stuff. But I remember thinking, oh, my son just took a few steps and I got to experience it because I took him with me and he didn't.
Yeah.
And right. He used to make these jokes of like, oh yeah, well, Cregan's off doing all these things.
Yeah.
Guess what I was doing? I was here working. And mm-hmm. I know he made it as a joke, mm-hmm. but I did feel that from him.
Yeah.
That, and I said, man, it's not fair. And what do I want? Mm-hmm. Am I going to do this and make it so that he can be with me?
Mm-hmm.
So at just some point, you're just going to.
And when Tony was little, before I did the management thing, we had a nanny and she was amazing. And I wasn't there for some things. I didn't want to put him in daycare. I wanted somebody there at home with him. And so I started to feel it then. She got to take him to the park and she showed him off. And I remember thinking, oh, this is hard. But thank God I thought she was amazing. And then she got married. And my parents moved here. And that's almost as good, having your parents right there. My mom raised me different. She was a little different caretaker than I wanted to be. And so I saw that mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, because she would get on my kids for certain things that I got. God rest your soul, mommy. But I didn't want my kids being raised like that.
Yeah.
And that was another thing. I'm like, even though my mom and dad are here and they're with the kids every minute of the day that they need to be, I was like, I want to raise kids. I want to raise people to be the people I want them to be, that I want to put out there in the world. And hopefully that's what was really important to me too.
So, which is interesting because you actually needed to depend on your parents a little bit more than you originally thought you would. Where in that journey, I know, what age were you when you were diagnosed?
I was 35. Tony was born in November of 92, and I was diagnosed in February.
And you were diagnosed with?
MS.
Yeah. One of the things I loved, which I'm going to make you restate, one of the things I loved about the last time we talked about MS was your explanation of it. So for most of us, I know, I remember my friend, we learned that her mom was diagnosed with MS when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh, it was a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know why it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
Or so does that mean that she's going to live? I didn't know. Mm-hmm. So can you explain to us a little bit more about how MS, what is MS mm-hmm. and how it affects you?
It's, they still don't know enough about it to this day, but it's where your body eats the myelin, I guess, it creates holes, or I probably did this better last time, but like you think of your nerves like as an electrical thing, mm-hmm. and there's plastic around the wires, and the plastic is like the myelin, which is what gets destroyed by your body, destroys the myelin around your nerves. And it can be anywhere in your brain. It can be in your spine. And there's no rhyme or reason as to why it affects this person that way, or hits this place or that place, whatever. It's very mysterious like that. And so for me, I've been just very blessed and not had any major kind of debilitation or anything. It's in my cognitive area, some damage there. And then also I have balance issues, and I've actually been having a little bit of exacerbation in the last couple of days, which I haven't really had in a long time, but my legs have been kind of not wanting to cooperate. And I've got, my foot is kind of numb on the bottom. So that's not really much when I think about other people. And my sister, she was very sick with it. She had primary progressive, and I have relapsing remitting. So it's kind of different for everybody. But I listened to my body. Like yesterday, I just pretty much stayed in bed all day, and I went to bed early. I feel better today. I'm not 100%, but I do feel better. And it actually showed its ugly head with optic neuritis with me first, which is one of the things that can happen when you have MS. So, yeah, that's
and that is it. Blurry vision, and
yeah, it's something about the nerves and your optic nerve. I woke up one morning when Tony was about 3 months old and I could not see out of half of my eye. And so it took me to the eye doctor and he sent me to the neurologist and they put me in the hospital and diagnosed me with after a lot of tests and stuff and put me on intravenous steroids. And it came back. My vision came back. And I lived my life with this knowledge of this disease. It didn't affect me, but I knew what it had done to my sister. And so I was constantly aware and tried to be very proactive with recognizing things that weren't right and then resting or doing whatever I needed to do to try.
Because your sister was in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And was she 19 or?
She was 19 when she was diagnosed.
And how long before she was in a wheelchair?
Well, it was a long time. She actually didn't end up in a wheelchair until she was in her 40s. And I don't know this, but she, back then, they really didn't know anything about it. They didn't have any medication or anything like that. And so she pretty much was in it denial, I think, about it, and did self-medicated and probably messed herself up a little bit. But when she started going downhill, it was like a very, very much of a decline without much stopping there. And she died in her 50s.
Mm-hmm. When you, I've told you this before, and I always loved your reaction, because when I first was signed with you guys, we were going to breakfast one morning to get to know one another. Mm-hmm. And I had been working with Russ. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Hey, I really want you to meet Debbie. If we're going to do this, we're a team. She's got to love you just as much." And I thought, well, that's great, because I love my mom and I have a really good family and my family dynamic is really important to me. So I love that this is happening here. And you actually had Tony and Olivia at that time. And he had said to me, "But I want to tell you something. You're going to talk to Debbie sometimes, and there's going to be some days where she's going to seem unengaged, or she's going to seem like she's not going to be herself, the self you come to love. And I just want you to understand that it's not her. It's her MS. And I want to tell you that because I don't want it to affect your relationship with her." And I was really... I was surprised, I guess, in a way, because I thought, oh, this is very serious. But as I learned about how it affected you, and sometimes you did say, "I don't feel well," or I'd be over there recording or something like that, and I wouldn't see you for 3 days, and I'd been there for 3 days and you were sleeping the whole time. Mm-hmm. But it really helped me have some sympathy for the family and making sure that I sat around and talked to the kids a little bit more and engaged with them if you weren't feeling well, because I wanted to make sure that they, you know, "Hey, how are you doing? How's school? How's your homework doing?" Knowing that's probably what you would have done. Mm-hmm. And I was appreciative of that warning ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that surprised me when you told me that about Russ. I didn't know he ever, because he never spoke to me about it.
Yeah.
I felt more like it was an annoyance to him more than anything.
And because it was something he couldn't control.
Oh.
He couldn't control you not feeling well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can't, especially as a producer who turns knobs and makes everything sound better or can cut things, and that's a hard thing to...
Don't defend Russ. Don't defend his ass to me. I don't know what you're talking about. No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah. But I can see how that would be very difficult for him to...
It was difficult. It was because nobody had control over it.
Yeah.
It was a very it's very unpredictable, which was the worst thing for him probably. But
well, and scared. There's probably a lot of fear behind that. Not that he would probably ever admit it, but that's mm-hmm. he then was on his own to be with kids.
Well, my mom and dad was around.
Yeah, thank goodness.
So he didn't have to worry too much about it.
Yeah. So. When your kids started growing up, though, and becoming aware that, oh, mom's not feeling well today, or mm-hmm. their grandparents had to come help, or
mm-hmm.
how was it that you maneuvered through that? Because, again, I was in high school when I learned about my friend. I had no idea what that meant. I couldn't imagine as a child trying to understand that. And what did you do to help them walk through that?
It's a very difficult thing to explain. And I can go be in the doctor's office and they tell me this and that and the other. But to go home and try to explain it, it's like trying to explain it here. It's not easy. So I understand why you're asking that. But they do have conferences kind of thing where you can take the family and it's a whole presentation about what this is and what it isn't and how you cope with it and why things happen and why people with MS can walk up to you one day and they seem perfectly normal and then the next day they can't really get there without a cane. So hearing it from the professionals was a great thing. I took the kids, Russ and I, and the kids went to a conference in Gatlinburg, I think it was. And after that, they looked at me a little different. They actually left there feeling empowered, I think. And it's like they kind of, especially Tony, he's
a bit older.
Yes. And he is a caretaker anyway. It was better for him to know a lot of that stuff because he was able to participate in my care in a different way. And I think it's important. My daughter called me recently because one of her dearest friends in New York where she lives, her mother had just been diagnosed. And they were all very confused and scared. And she said, how did you find out about that thing we went to? What was that? And how did you find out about it? And how do I get that information to them? And I told her and stuff, and she was like, okay, because she remembered it helped her. And so hopefully made a difference for her friend's mom and their family. They have celebrity spokespeople that have it. Remember Terry Garr was there when we went, and she was very brave, and she had very hard. She said it was a very difficult thing. She had a bad case of it. But hearing it from somebody that you see in movies and whatever, they tell you their story and everything, it's like, it puts a different dynamic on it. And it's easier to comprehend some things. So that's how we kind of did that, I think.
Yeah. Talk about caregiving. Your son, it's very, do you think that he is a caregiver a little bit more because of that? Or just, it's partly in his nature.
It is. But I think it might have spurred on some of that. What's the word I'm looking at? Part of the reason why he likes to know, he's very well read. Mm-hmm.
He wants all the information
things.
So that he can assess the situation.
Yes, he wants to understand it and know what he can do, what he needs to do or what he doesn't need to do or and not just health stuff. I mean, it's everything about the world, about everything.
Yeah.
So that's kind of who he is. But I think that might have spurred on that whole thing a little bit. And then taking care of my mom and dad too, helped with that a great deal.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of who he is.
It is. I remember when you were telling me about your uncle and how he was like early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the executor of the estate.
And it was quite an estate. And my uncle, Tony, was the only one he really trusted to do it. But they'd become very close since Tony was a little kid. He was my dad's twin brother. And he loved Tony, and Tony adored him. And my uncle and his own son were estranged. And so he kind of took to Tony a little bit. And Tony has always been very careful with money and just paid attention. He pays attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so my Uncle Doyle put him in charge. And who am I to say, wait a minute, I'm the oldest niece or whatever. It's like, I'd rather Tony take care of me anyways. It's a lot of pain in the butt.
And is he's still coming around taking care of you?
Yeah, when I can get him over there, he's got a busy life. But sometimes, like I texted him today, hey, can you come over and help me put up my blinds that Lisa gave me for my windows? Yeah, probably this weekend.
I want you right now.
But yeah, he's got a full, I mean, he's 31 years old. He's got a life, but when he needs to, he's there. He steps up.
Yeah.
And he steps up for his dad too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Well, I just have some questions about, because I want to know a little bit more about, how do you know, because you said, oh, I just take some naps or I sleep for days. How do you know that it's coming? How do you know it's coming on?
I'll tell you, I get so exhausted. It's way back when I would know that something was coming on when I had to hold my coffee cup with two hands. Because we're all drinking our coffee, whatever. But when it would come on, I'd have to hold it with two hands. And I knew my legs would get very weak. And I would just be, I couldn't hardly think straight. I would just get completely exhausted, for lack of a better word. And my legs would feel like the bones, but it felt like everything was soft in there and nothing was going to, it wasn't going to hold me up. And that, for, I just don't know how else to explain it, but that, and when I'd go to bed, I'd have to go to bed and I would sleep. And I mean, it would take days sometimes. But if I did that, when I'd get up after however long, I would, it's so weird. I mean, I would know after waking up, after sleeping 12 hours, or I would know after getting up, after being in the bed for 3 days, would know when that time was when I felt strong again.
And there's no cure for it.
Mm-mm.
But are there treatments that they can give you other than the steroids that you mentioned?
Yes,
for your eyes?
They have injectable medicines and some through the mouth, and they're very strong. I've taken some on occasion, trying some things. But I would get sicker when I took them, because it's like you would take an injection one day and then you wouldn't take it for 3 days and you take another one. And then, you know, like that. And and when you would take, it would make me sick. I felt like I had the flu, and I would be in bed for 2-3 days feeling like that. And just when I'd start to feel better, it'd be time to take another injection. They were very painful for me too. And so I did it for about 3 months, because they say it takes about 3 months for it to get you to get past the sick part, the side effects, whatever. And I don't know if it would have gotten better after that 3 months, but I couldn't take it anymore because I couldn't work. I couldn't work, and I was just useless. And I felt like I do fine without taking that stuff. I have my moments, but I'd rather take the chance of something down the road than miss out on my life right now. I couldn't deal with it. And my doctor did not like that at all. And he tried to scare me into taking stuff. Well, anything could change. Your sister didn't get bad for how many years or whatever. And I just changed neurologist. I didn't like to talk. I just changed my doctor. And I've never taken anything since then. Never. So.
Well, you're lucky to have a career that you can.
Mm-hmm.
When you need to take the time, you can take the time. And
yeah, I've been able to do that.
Yeah. That's a very, I think that's probably maybe others' hardest aspect.
True.
Of, because you can't take 3 days off
right
consistently without
Absolutely.
Somebody above you saying, hey, what are you doing?
It's true. My sister ended up on disability because she couldn't keep a job. And I just decided, for me, this is what I'm going to do. And it's very unlikely, they tell me, that I'm going to take a turn for like the wheelchair or whatever at this point, because I've had it so long. I mean, they don't know that. They can't guarantee it, but based on other people and what have you. And I'm almost 67 now, and something happens where I take a turn and have to have a cane again or whatever it is. Well, I'll be an old lady, and that's okay. But I didn't want to spend even half of my life not participating in it.
Yeah, that's a hard decision to make.
It was.
Especially if you think something's going to make you better. But feel it. Was there,
that's true.
When they said your neurologist at first, would he say that, oh, well, if you take it for 6 months, it's going to get better after a certain time? Or was it just...
They said typically it takes 3 months for the side effects to go away, if they're going to go away. But it was supposed to like kind of get better
as you went.
Yeah. And it never did. It was terrible every time I took it. And I would cry when it was time for me to take it. My mom was the only one that could give me my injection.
Mm. Where was your injection in your hip? Thank you, Mama. Yep. That's what they're there for. What's making you tear up right now?
Just thinking about her.
I made a post the other day about grief. I was listening to something about a Costco. Talking about Costco. And I remember, I grew up in California where Costcos were always a thing. But my mother-in-law she learned why I loved Costco so much. And she called me and said, oh, you have to watch this documentary. You're going to love it. And I did. It was like, oh, yes, of course. That's why Costco's so great. It does this thing. But in that moment, just listening to a thing about Costco, I just started crying.
No.
Because I missed her for a moment.
Yeah.
I just thought.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting thing. What makes you think or really affects you in that deep part, because when you touch it, I would always say I say this to my children. I said, the pain doesn't go away. Like, it's not there. If you pinpoint it, sometimes it gets, the area that it takes up is smaller. Mm-hmm. But if you pinpoint it just right, it hurts just as much in that moment. Mm-hmm. Or it feels maybe a little more distant. But
yeah,
that pain is something that, and it's okay to feel that. It's okay to acknowledge it.
Well, it's what makes us human. It's what makes us the emotional beings we are. And I feel my parents around all the time, especially lately.
What in particular makes you think about them lately?
Oh, I've just been going through some stuff. Mm. My sister and I were having our usual FaceTime call, and we talk almost every morning. She lives in Oregon. And we were talking about how much we miss them. And it was real. They say that the cardinal shows up and that means something. And because I've been going through a hard time, and I was driving and I was just thinking, God, I wish my dad was here. And a cardinal flew right towards my windshield and went up like that and over my car. And I was like, okay, you're here. But that doesn't mean you can help me. But yeah, just.
What a sign.
Yeah, it was very cool. Very cool.
Oh, I love that. Well, what do you do now? So you live alone. When you have, do you have somebody to call? Do you have somebody to, what do you do when you reach out and you say, I'm having that moment? Other than, because you're at a point where you don't have to call 911. You know what's happening. What are the steps you take now?
I have a wonderful friend circle, and you know what that's all about. And I feel so lucky that I have the friends I do. I don't know what I'd do without them. And I don't know what I'd do without my sister. She's not here, but she's such a support to me. And my kids, Tony, of course. I've been married 3 times, and clearly that's not working for me. So I think I've just been blessed with a support friend group that I know is there for me.
Yeah.
And I'm there for them. And I'm fearless for my friends, and I feel like they are for me too. So that's, I know they're there if I need it.
Yeah, it's an important thing. When I was younger, I had brothers, so I got along with the boys, was rough and tumble. And when I was in college, I remember I was placed in my freshman year, I was placed in a dorm that had girls on the first floor, boys on the second floor, and then girls on the third floor. And it was the only one like that on the whole campus. And I'm like, my gosh. And then I was in an a cappella group that was all women. And I thought, what are you trying to tell me? I did have to take stock at that moment because it was like all of these things were happening for me to be around women more and to finally understand why we need each other and what the value is. Yeah.
I tell you, I when we had the publishing company and you were there and Deanna was there and Jenny and Carrie, and it was, you guys were amazing for me during a very difficult time in my life. You guys rallied around me and never forget it.
You were our matriarch. And I'm glad that you are still here with us to experience that, because those things, and I think that says a lot, that connection with people in those moments where I moved here with nobody too. And having that publishing company, just like you, I felt like I had a family. Mm-hmm. And that family and those girls, I had Jenny on the podcast already with me. Mm-hmm. Carrie, she'll be on here too.
Yeah. And we're all still
connected,
checking on each other and staying connected. Yes, absolutely. It's just such a, that's why we're put on this earth.
Yeah. And life gets in the way. It gets in the way for us. And it,
but we all know.
We do.
I know you guys love me. I love you. I might not talk to you, might not see you. Your birthdays go by. I don't say happy birthday, but I love you guys so much. And I know y'all love me.
Yeah.
And that's never going to change.
That's one of the really positive things about social media.
Yes, it is.
Is that
it is, for sure.
You can stay connected to and need to. I think that's why, again, I've said this before in here, is that I love this because I've made some space to pull those people in that I really love or that have stories that I just want to sit and talk to them for a while.
Right.
And reconnect. But the funny thing is when you walked in, it's like no time had passed.
That's true.
It's just like we were sitting down like we did.
I go, I must love you a lot because that traffic tonight. It's like I'm talking to you like I just saw you yesterday.
Exactly.
Instead of, oh, how are you?
Yeah. So I love that. Which brings me to some parts of the podcast that I really love at the end. And that is to tell me, first we'll go with the, what time in the last 7 days did you not feel good enough?
Oh, I forgot that question. Oh, God.
And we're still recording. So this time you get, it's on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a lot of different 7 days than the last time I was here. So Barbara, whatever we're going to call you today. I don't know. I had a little conversation, so to speak, with a very dear friend, peer in the business, that kind of a friend in business. And I felt very betrayed. And I did not, and I felt like, well, what's wrong with me? Big time. And I'm still thinking about it. I haven't spoken to her since yesterday. And I don't know if I'm going to. I'm very hurt. And what I'm supposed to be doing right now. Am I not enough? Do I not have a place anymore? Do I need to dig into my place? Do I need to, it's what it's been. So.
Is that centered more around work or your personal?
Work.
Yeah.
Which is my personal, for God's sake. It's ridiculous, but it's true.
Well, when you do work in a creative environment around songs that become your life and soundtracks to your life, it's hard to separate them then at that point.
It is. And when I it's entangled. Because I have such good friends in the music business still, and it's all kind of entangled. So it's a feeling of, am I inconsequential now? Or am I being oversensitive? And I haven't decided exactly what I am yet. I am hurt, and I have to figure that out, because you get to a certain point in this business and it's not, you can't age out of it. So I need to think, is that where I am, Or am I Jeannie Seely? Am I going to Jeannie Seely my ass? Because she's like an icon and she's my hero. So.
Who likely has her own issues.
Well, we all do. But yeah. By golly, nobody's going to push her out of nothing. And she's still great. She's still so great. So thanks for asking that.
Well, I'll tell you mine. Mine was actually last night when I was asking my daughter how her teacups were. And she goes, Mom, for the fourth time, I did not have teacups today.
Oh.
And at first I was like, well, excuse me. But she quickly walked that back because we have conversations lots of times about tone. And she quickly walked that back. She said, Mom, I did tell you that I was done with TCAP last night and this morning. And I was like, well, are you sure? Of course, I'm trying to talk her through it. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I clearly was not actually listening to you well. It made me stop for a minute and say, if you're going to ask your daughter a question, stop for a minute and listen to the answer.
Oh boy, we do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we try to multitask and multi-think. And sometimes we miss some things.
Yeah. There are those moments where they're, Mom, hey, Mom.
But what the hell is your daughter doing taking a teacup? She's a baby.
She's not anymore.
I know. Oh. My God. I'm just shrugging.
I know. All right. So more positive for you. I would love for you to think about the time in the last week that you had a glimmer.
Oh, the glimmer. Okay. Oh, I know when it was. Because my sister, we've talked the last couple of days, and she knows what I've been going through, and I've cried. And so out of the blue today, what did she do? She sent me flowers. A beautiful bouquet of flowers. Just because, she says, just because, love you. So that was unexpected and just glimmered my day right up.
Isn't it funny? What is it about flowers that just... There's just their color, life. They smell good.
For a little bit, I was delivering flowers for a friend of mine. She needed extra help on holidays, and I used the cash. I loved it. I loved having all those bouquets in my car. I loved
walking those. Your car must have smelled so good.
Oh, my God. And I loved walking those bouquets up to the door. It just makes people stay. It's like somebody's thinking about me.
Yeah.
And then there's this beautiful recognition of it. I buy flowers for myself all the time. All the time.
Yeah. I like to, I don't do it very much anymore, but there were times when I'd buy flowers and I'd say, I'm buying for myself.
Absolutely. I do.
Make me feel good.
I love them. Every time I look at my flowers in my house, it makes me happy.
Yeah. I had a high school boyfriend that would give me flowers and I never understood why. But he just would do it, and it was very sweet.
That's very sweet.
It was very sweet. Okay, so glimmer for me.
Whoa.
Oh, well, I know what the glimmer was. My son, I was really proud of him. Now, he's a little guy, and so he hasn't had a growth spurt. And to be honest, he gets picked on a lot.
Oh.
But he's got such a funny, goofy, little fun attitude. But sometimes it comes out a little differently, and especially when he's on the soccer field. And so he had a game, and it was a round robin, but essentially if they won the game, they were going to win the tournament. So it was an important game. And so he was running down, and for some reason, this other little kid who was about his size just wailed him right in the back. I mean, everybody was like, whoa. And he looks over at us and he's like, and he just kind of shook his head and was like,
What the heck?
Yeah, but he just laughed it off, like, and he didn't give up. It was like, oh, okay, well, I'll just beat you. Mm-hmm. I'll run faster than you, or I don't know what your problem was in this moment, but I'm gonna play some soccer here.
Mm-hmm.
And I really was proud of him in that moment because he could have done one of two things. I've seen him before mm-hmm. give up
mm-hmm.
and feel deflated or start kind of feeling more injured, or I've seen him retaliate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was really proud of him for just keeping his cool mm-hmm. And just taking it out on the field.
That's really, it says a lot about how he viewed that. Because it's like you say, everybody's going, what in the world was that?
Yeah.
And he had enough awareness to go, well, that was just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the reason for a full context of it, I think the reason that I was really proud of him is because the night before or two nights before we had, I think it's the night before, his Scarlett's friend was over and they had turned off his video games and he was really mad. And he came downstairs and he told us, she turned off my video games. I wasn't done. And now they're watching something. They won't turn it off. Fully expecting that I would jump to his side, which he was in the right in that moment. But I said, hey, you do play video games a lot. Like, you get that TV a lot. I will talk to your sister, but can you just give it to them this one time? He was really mad. And he didn't control it in that moment. Mm. He had some little plastic thing in his hand and he threw it down on the ground and you could hear him moving into his room. And so I know we ended up talking about it afterwards and I understood his frustration and I did tell him, it is okay to be mad. I want you, if you're angry, I don't want you to hold it in, but I also don't want you to be destructive. I want you to take it out on things that, you know, and so he heard that. So I think that's why that glimmer really meant something in that moment, because he had just experienced it the night before. So,
yeah,
there you go.
That's hard.
I know. Growing up is hard. Yeah, adulting is hard.
Yeah, life is hard, period. It gets up and down, some harder than other times, but we get through it, I guess.
We do. We? Well, I really appreciate you coming and taking some time to explain to me again about MS and how it shows up differently for everybody.
It does.
And do you know, one other last thing that I wanted to tell you is that we had a conversation, it was just a week and a half ago, really, that we were trying to record. But I learned so much talking to you that there is another young woman who is going through something with her legs and all of these things. And I came up to her the next day and I was like, hey, I'm not a doctor, obviously, but have they tested you yet for MS? And she's actually getting an MRI this Sunday.
Oh, wow.
So I'm really excited for her that potentially she might have some answers, whatever it may be.
It's hard to diagnose. It still is hard to diagnose. And they don't necessarily always go to that, but because I had the optic neuritis, it was a natural jump. But a lot of people I know go for years and they don't diagnose them correctly, and they live with it until somebody finally does.
Yeah.
So hopefully,
one last question I have for you is, it, and I should know this because I should have looked it up, but is it genetic? Like, is it?
It is genetic.
It's hereditary?
It's genetic.
Okay.
Which is different than hereditary.
Yes, that's why I said both of those.
But yes, it is genetic. And so, like, if you have a sibling with it, last time I looked, you're 7 times more predisposed to having it as well. So there is some genetics to it.
Well, thank you for sharing
that.
That's
one of the only things they know about it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for coming and sharing with us and for sharing your heart with me today.
Of course, anytime. You own a little piece of my heart, lady.
You own a pretty substantial chunk of mine, too. So until next time, I hope everyone has some glimmers that they see in their week.
Let's hope.
And we will see you next week.